A1.
Number 6A.
Now we come to the fourth side of this holy city, to science. Now we have seen on that third side of the holy city in Christianity, when considering creation and man, that the Bible really presents two records of creation. One record shows us a great deduction from God, presents, so to say, man and the universe as the outcome of the divine principle, and therefore as a universe that is godlike, that has only the qualities and nature of God. And on the other side, we had a second record of creation, which does not deduce everything from God, but which is a human concept of man and the universe, a human concept of God, and therefore presents a creation, inclusive man, that is material, that is evil, imperfect, ending in death. So we can ask ourselves the great question, which of these two creations are true, or are both true? Are there two worlds, two or even more worlds, two or more concepts of man that are real? In other words, it is the question, is there a spiritual creation or world? And next to it, say, a mental world? And next to it, say, a psychological world, next to it the material world, or even next to it a world of material forces and energy. See, the human concept has many worlds, many universes, universes that to a great extent contradict each other in nature. Well, is therefore reality something which is contradictory? Or is one concept true and the other wrong? Well, these are questions which can only be explained through the fourth side of the holy city, through science. We have seen the fourth side, the fourth point of this operating principle, is that side where we ask after the truth of the things, where we ask which is the authority that teaches us all truth. So this office of the fourth side of the holy city is the office of science. And I want to spend quite a long time on this fourth side of the holy city, because this fourth side should give us the answer to what is true and what is false, what is real and what is unreal. Now, in general, there are always two sources of knowledge. The first source of knowledge is usually that direct revelation of God. A real, true revelation of God is usually a knowledge which we gain in one shot, so to say, at once. It just breaks on human consciousness and reveals a new truth. The second source of knowledge which we can use is science, is scientific reasoning, is divine logic. Le Comte de Nuit, whom you know as a very famous writer of that bestseller, Human Destiny, he writes right at the beginning of his book about these two ways of gaining knowledge. He says, two different paths may eventually lead to the comprehension of man. See, there are two paths which lead to knowledge, to comprehension. He says, the first, revelation, is a direct road, but is closed to a great many people and independent of rational thought. Those who can make use of it are fortunate. Then he goes on and shows the second source of knowledge. He says, the second, on the contrary, is strictly rational and scientific. Now, in considering the science of being, the reality of being, we really can use both methods of gaining knowledge. We can rely on revelation and the book, which is called the Bible, is really a book in which the revelations of God are written down. Or we can use the second way of scientific divine reasoning from a divine principle, a method which has been used mostly, I say mostly, not uniquely, mostly by Mrs. Eddy in writing the textbook. So let us first consult what direct divine revelation has said on this question of reality. What is real? Is the spiritual universe real, or is the material universe real, or are both real? So let's first take revelation and turn to the Bible. The Bible never says that God is matter, or that God is flesh, or that God is corporeal. The Bible always says that God is spirit. So Jesus would say, God is spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. So only worshiping in spirit will really be worshiping in truth, because revelation has shown through the biblical writers that God is spirit, that we cannot see God with our five physical senses, that he is intangible to the five physical senses. So revelation through the whole Bible teaches that God is spirit and not matter. There is no indication in the Bible that God created the flesh or created matter. And there is no indication whatever that Jesus therefore would serve matter or would serve the flesh or worship matter or worship the flesh. That he would use for his healing material means or fleshly means. But what he did is that he subdued matter to spirit, showing that for him the spiritual is the real and the true, and not the fleshly and not the material, corporeal or physical. He says, it is the spirit that quickeneth. The flesh profiteth nothing. To him flesh was nothing, no thing. To him spirit was all, and the only reality. That's why Mrs. Eddy says of Jesus that Jesus spoke of the flesh and spirit as the two opposites, So we come to that point where we see that really what revelation, direct revelation, has shown is that spirit and matter are opposites, are antitheses, and not two equal reality, two realities equal to each other, and true. Now, if we take the second way of gaining knowledge, namely scientific logic and scientific deduction, we really can get those conclusions which Mrs. Eddy got. Her scientific reasoning was that she relied on the fact that there is one God, and that that one God therefore must be spirit, because only spirit is all in all. Matter is limited. So as there is only one God, therefore only the creation of God, spirit, can be real and true. Consequently, this is the reason, consequently, matter, which is the antithesis of spirit, and the material creation, must be unreal and untrue. See, it's a very brave logical reasoning from a principle, deducting from that principle, and arriving at a statement of the nature of the idea. If God is spirit, she says, and is all, then that which is created by spirit is spiritual, and that God is all, therefore all creation is spiritual, therefore the antithesis of it, namely matter and the flesh, cannot be anything, must be nothing or unreal and untrue. In this way, Mrs. Eddy combines reason and revelation. She combines the conclusions of revelation with those of divine reasoning, and shows really that there is no contradiction between true scientific reasoning and true revelation. And quite interestingly, therefore, she speaks of her scientific revelation. You see, she combines those two methods of gaining knowledge of science with revelation, and calls her discovery a scientific revelation, because in that revelation, reason and revelation are reconciled. She says, in following these leadings of scientific revelation, the Bible was my only textbook. The scriptures were illumined. Reason and revelation were reconciled. And afterwards, the truth of Christian Science was demonstrated. What really is the pith of her scientific revelation? The pith of it really is that she saw that matter is nothing. She says in her textbook, matter is naught, and therefore also the awful unreality called evil. I think perhaps these two points are the pith of her scientific revelation, which she puts down, that matter is naught, that evil is naught too, that evil is unreal. Well, both revelation and divine logic, in this case, contradict the human concept of creation and so-called reality. The human concept of creation is that matter is real, is tangible, it can be measured. The human concept is that evil is a reality, that it is a power, and that we suffer under it. So there must be an answer. You see, the question, which is the most important question now under consideration, that as well revelation as given through the Bible, as well as divine reasoning as shown by Mrs. Eddy, both these great sources of knowledge show the impossibility that matter can be real and true, that evil can be real and true, and yet the whole human concept we have of human life and of the creation is the very contrary, the very opposite of it. And so I come to a further big question which we have to investigate, namely that big contradiction which exists between science and the five physical senses. It is only the five physical senses which tell us that matter is real and that evil is real and actual. Science, as we have seen in Revelation, has denied that, but the five physical senses affirm it. And so this whole question, what is real and what is true, is really a argument between, is science true or are the five physical senses true? If we can find out that only science is true and that the five physical senses are untrue, then naturally that whole question will be solved. So let me dwell for some length on this question of science versus the testimony of the physical senses. The question therefore is, can the five physical senses really testify to truth? Is it possible that our means of testimony and of conception, which mortal man has, the five senses, is it possible that they tell us the truth? Or are they big liars that deceive us every moment? Well, we know from experience, even if you don't reason very deeply, that the five physical senses are utterly unreliable, that they are utterly limited. And therefore, already on account of the fact that they are very limited, that they cannot testify really to the truth. Whereas science, which reasons in the realm of the infinite, of the unlimited, which reasons with logic, science really is that means which can tell us what is true, that can investigate what is true. And so we begin to realize really that which must be uncovered and destroyed is that we rely too much on the testimony of the physical senses instead of relying on a scientific consciousness, of scientific understanding. And it was always that unwillingness to let us be informed through science instead of through the five physical senses that has brought us disaster, bondage. Mrs. Eddy says that very nicely when she writes in the textbook, humanity advances slowly out of sinning sense into spiritual understanding. And why does that happen so slowly? And she answers, unwillingness to learn all things rightly, binds Christendom with chains. And it is exactly this point which is so important to conceive, that it is our unwillingness to learn all things rightly which brings us all the trouble. If we would be willing to believe in science, to trust scientific information, to trust scientific understanding, then we would free ourselves really from all the troubles which only spring up from our trust in the testimony of the physical senses. Yes, the five physical senses are unreliable, and we know that from human experience. You know all those optical illusions which you may encounter day after day. For instance, you know that if you put a straight stick into the water, it appears to be broken. You know, for instance, if you look along two parallel rails, railway rails, into the far distance, you think that they get narrower and narrower and meet at a distant point, that they are not parallel. Or we think that the sky touches the earth at the horizon, that they meet there, and yet they never meet. Such illustrations could be multiplied and multiplied, all showing that the five physical senses are deceiving us time after time. And you know how long it takes to adopt scientific understanding which is contrary to the testimony of the physical senses. Think, for instance, of the sun and the earth. Well, since Galileo, we know that the sun, in relation to the earth, stands still, that the earth moves around the sun and not the sun around the earth. Since then, about 300 years have passed, and since 300 years, everybody in school has been taught that fact. Every child knows it, everybody knows it, and yet, because it contradicts the constant testimony of the physical senses, we still talk as if the sun would be moving and the earth would stand still. We still say that the sun gets up in the east and goes down in the west. In spite that we know from scientific understanding that this is not so. You see, it is a hard struggle to let the senses be informed by science. It seems that the science always seems to be the stronger against scientific understanding. And within this long battle, we must see that we gain the victory of a scientific consciousness over a consciousness which is molded by the testimony of the five physical senses. And so I would like to show you how deceptive the five physical senses are, so as more or less to impregnate our consciousness with the fact that we should turn towards science and scientific reasoning when we want to know the truth about something. And in order to show that, I would like to take some illustrations which are rather clever and which show really that the senses are deluding us over and over and over. I take the first illustration again from Dunois's book Human Destiny, and he gives the following picture. He says, I read from his book, Let us suppose that we have at our disposal two powders. One white flour and the other black, finely crushed charcoal or soot. If we mix them, we will obtain a gray powder, which will be lighter in color if it contains more flour and darker if it contains more soot. If the mixture is perfect, on our scale of observation, this is the main point, on our scale of observation, that is, without the help of a microscope, the phenomenon studied will always be a gray powder. But let us suppose that an insect of the size of the grains of flour or of the soot moves around in this powder. For him, for the insect, for him, there will be no gray powder, but only black or white boulders. On his scale of observation, the phenomenon gray powder does not exist. That's how far he goes. You can see what he wants to bring out. There is a powder, a mixture of white and black powder. That heap of powder seems to me gray, but to the insect it doesn't seem gray. He doesn't know anything about gray. He says, oh no, if I climb over this hill, I climb over a very, very white boulder, and then again comes a very black boulder. What are you talking about gray? So if I had a little conversation with this insect, we would never understand each other about the color of the same object. The object is the same. And yet, because we have a different scale of observation, as Dunois calls it, we come to very different conclusions. So we can begin to realize, really, that the color like gray or white or black doesn't exist in the object, but exists in the subject, in our subjective view. And if I change the subjective view, say from a man to the insect, the object changes. So there is no objective reality in an object. All that there is true about an object is always subjective, and that changes. Now, if that's clear, now, he takes another example in the same line, but one that is even more interesting. He writes, on our scale of observation, the edge of a razor blade is a continuous line. On the microscopic scale, it is a broken but solid line. We get at once a different picture of the same thing. It's always a razor blade, but the moment we change our standpoint, we get a different picture. He goes on the chemical scale, we have atoms of iron and carbon, because a razor blade is made up of iron and carbon. So from a chemical scale of observation, we don't have a straight line or a zigzag line, but we have again atoms or boulders of iron and carbon. He goes on the subatomic scale, we have electrons in perpetual motion which travel at the rate of several thousand miles per second. So if I look at the same object from a different standpoint, namely from the subatomic standpoint, all what I see is something like a swarm of gnats. Just a lot of air and empty space, and then little tiny electrons running around in terrific speed. Then he goes on and says, all these phenomena are in reality the manifestation of the same basic phenomenon, the motions of the electrons. The only difference which exists between them is the scale of observation. It's always the observer that determines how the object looks like. It isn't the object that tells us how the object looks like. Now, this is the main point for the next few hours of our talk, it seems, that the object never tells us what it is, that it is always the subject that approaches the object. Only that subject determines what the object really looks like. So he draws the lesson and says, in other words, one can say that from the standpoint of man, it is the scale of observation which creates the phenomenon. Every time we change the scale of observation, we encounter new phenomena. So, you see what he says? He says, it is really the observer of the outward world that creates the form of the outward world. It isn't that the outward world is created and is unchangeable and is just what it is, and then tries to convey to us what it is. It's just the other way around. It is our scale of observation, it's our way of looking at things, which creates the form of that thing. And that is the pith of Christian Science and of metaphysics. If we can't understand that, then we will always be in a turmoil. We'll never find our way. We must see that what exists always exists in our consciousness and never outside of consciousness. Never outside of consciousness. And therefore, that in the measure as we change our consciousness, the phenomena changes. If I change from the scale of how I look at that heap of flour and soot to the scale of how an insect looks at it, the object changes. If I look at that razor blade from the chemical standpoint to the subatomic standpoint, the object changes. I have a very different object. So, this point we will keep in mind.